Today I'm delighted to be talking to one of our listeners, just 1 week after her 103rd birthday. So first of all, Mary Overill, many happy returns. And thank you for inviting me to have a chat, particularly at this time when the world marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe.
Yes, well, thank you very much for asking me to talk to you, yes.
Well, you were born in Buckfast Lee in Devon.
I was.
In 1922.
Yes.
You were just saying the first day of spring, the 21st of March.
21st, yes.
And you grew up in Ashburton.
No, I grew up in Buckfast Lee.
Oh, you grew up there.
I went to school in Ashburton.
I beg your pardon.
No, but the first school I went to was in the vicarage in Buckfast Lee, and there were about four people in there.
Oh.
And so it was a very, very small, and I must have been just about barely five, I should think, when I went there first.
Another world from today.
Yes.
So you attended school through the 1920s and 30s.
Yes.
Then you, I think you went to Tech to learn how to be a secretary.
I did. I took shorthand and typing lessons and things like that. Yes, I was turned out quite proficient.
Wow.
Yes.
Do you think you can still remember how to do shorthand? Is that something that stays with you?
Some of the easy words, yeah. I might, but other than that, no, I don't
think. But you probably got up to quite a good speed back when you were...
I must have done, yes, because I was...
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, by the age of 20, you were working for an accountant, I think, in Totnes.
I was, yes.
And it was at this stage that you were called up.
I was.
And you joined the RAF as a WAF, a Women's Auxiliary Air Force.
I did, yes.
Now, how does that work? Do you just get the call? You get a letter saying you have to report somewhere?
Yes, you don't get any call because we didn't have a telephone in our house. No, they just send you a note to say that will you appear on a certain day, and included would be the thing that would help you get on the train, and you were just sent to somewhere.
Yes.
And there was me hoping to be sent to somewhere interesting.
Yes.
Instead of that, I was sent back to Plymouth.
Oh.
22 miles from home.
Ah. But I believe you did some training in, I think you mentioned to me, Morecambe.
Morecambe, yes. I learned how to march up and down.
Oh, really?
And yes, and we were marched from one area to the next, and we went to and fro to the various piers.
Yeah.
And you went to one pier for one lecture, and then you were marched along. And oh dear, yes. It was
a bit monotonous, perhaps.
Yes, yes. But it was very interesting. But it was from there that I was posted, and I was sort of quite sort of sure that I would be posted to somewhere that would be new to me, anywhere.
And you came back to Plymouth.
Yeah.
Just to ask, why the RAF? Did you have a choice?
I always liked the Air Force blue.
Oh, right, that was the colour.
Yes, and I knew various young men in the Air Force, and so I thought, well, why not the Air Force?
Yeah, but I don't suppose you got to see much aircraft. You're not up close and personal, did you?
Not Plymouth, no.
No,
but
no.
I went from Plymouth after about 6 months or so there. I was sent to St. Evel, just outside Newquay, in Cornwall.
In Cornwall. Ah, well, tell me about that then. What was that work like?
Well, that was quite a different matter of thing, because there were big aircraft there, Liberators,
yes,
with a crew of eight every time they went off. And they used to be out hunting for submarines in the western approaches, anywhere around the coast of... anywhere around in the north coast, around the Irish.
Quite a long distance.
Yes, and it was, we were losing an awful lot of shipping that was being attacked by submarines.
Yeah. So what sort of work were you doing? You were in the ops room?
I worked for Shackleton.
Can I just add here, this was Squadron Leader Shackleton.
Squadron Leader Shackleton.
And he was the son of the famous...
He was the
Ernest
explorer.
Shackleton. Yeah.
Yes.
What was he like to work with?
Well, he was a bit abrupt.
Yes.
He was very, very efficient. You know, you sort of hesitated to ask him to repeat some of the words that he might have used, and I couldn't get them down quick enough.
So he was dictating to you, was he?
Not always, but sometimes he did.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was a bit difficult then.
Wow.
But, no, I managed all right, and we were in a little office, and yes.
Yes. I mean, it wasn't all work. I assume you had some social time. Were you able to go out of an evening sometimes?
Oh, yes, because our billets, we slept in an area called Porth, which is just outside Newquay. We were able to get into Newquay by walking mainly, but sometimes there would be RAF transport that could take you.
Ship after ship from the New World brings to Britain fresh thousands of American soldiers to the springboard for invasion. These little islands that stood alone 3 years ago when the darkness descended upon Europe, these little islands now become the barracks, the headquarters and the advanced supply dump for the re-entry of the continent of Europe.
I'm back talking to Mary Overill, who left us on a bit of a cliffhanger earlier. It's 1943. Mary is working for Squadron Leader Shackleton near Newquay on coastal command operations, and the Americans have arrived. Evening dances with American airmen are now a perk of the job. Now, one in particular took a shine to you, Mary, so how about telling us a bit more about that?
Well, yes. We were followed around on the camp by all Americans who were trying to learn about the running of an English camp. So they came straight from America, really. And I was amazed to find that one of them was the son of a Kennedy. And he actually asked me to go to the pictures with him.
Oh.
So I went to the... I can't remember. I must have met him in the pictures, probably, or in the area in Newquay. And the first thing he wanted to do was to go into a sort of a bar place and have something to eat.
Mm.
And he had a big piece of apple tart with a big lump of cheese on the top. And now I think of it, I think that probably that cheese would have probably been enough ration for one person for the week. And he was messing about and leaving it, and I didn't like that a bit.
Did you say anything?
No, I don't think I did say anything, no.
Well, just to say...
I was a bit frightened of anything,
really. But you went to the pictures, and I'm sure you had a lovely evening. But this is actually Joe Kennedy, who I think was the eldest of the family.
He was the older
brother of JFK.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
John Kennedy. And just to tell listeners, he was actually killed in action, wasn't he?
He was, yes. I don't know whether it was in action or it was a plane that came down.
I really don't know. It said, when I looked up on the... I did my research. It said he was flying and he crashed in a combat mission over Europe in August 1944. So that would have been about a year after you knew him. So that's interesting. Any other Americans or just the one?
Well, no, I think it was mainly that one. But anyway, we went to the pictures.
Yeah.
And I expect we held hands and messed about a little bit. But and afterwards, we went out to where he could catch... They had a special transport that would take them all back to the camp, which was a couple of miles along the coast from Newquay. And he said, oh yes, we'll drop you off when we go past your place. And I said, well, it's getting very late, I really can't stop. And in the end I said, well, it's no good, I've got to go. And I said, well, I've got to go, and I shall walk back, and I shall scrape in just about in time for 11 o'clock or something, I think it would have been. And so I walked away from him and left him there.
Well.
I thought, well, that was it.
Well, good for you, standing up to the Americans. Yes. We want a bit more of that, don't we?
Yes.
So, not long after that, I guess, you got a call to move. Tell us about that.
I did. Well, I was suddenly asked to go to see the WAF officer of the camp. And I was horrified. I thought, oh dear, what have I done?
You've upset the Kennedys, that's what you've done.
Yeah, could have done. So I went along to her and she said, oh, well, you know, okay, well, tell me, have you ever applied for a commission? And I said, no, I hadn't, no. And have you any reason to know that you would be asked to go to London? And I said, no, I didn't know anything about it at all. And she said, well, I'm afraid you're posted to Air Ministry.
So this, the Air Ministry in the middle of London,
yes,
Whitehall?
It's in Whitehall. And so all I could do was think, oh God, what have I...
Well,
I
so you had no choice?
No choice
at all.
No.
So off you went.
And so in a day or so, I got my railway pass and everything to go, and I just had to catch the train and go up to Plymouth and probably get on the main line to London.
Yeah.
And away I went.
Yeah.
And I had to find my way around London and find out where I was working.
Yeah. Had you ever been to London before?
Well, I had, yeah, but I'd only been to visit a friend vaguely, and I didn't know anything about London.
Was there did you see a lot of bomb damage when you were there?
I don't think I really did see an awful lot of it. Not really.
Yeah.
I can't remember being sort of astonished by too much.
No.
Damage.
Of course, by this time in the war, there were fewer air raids, I believe.
There were. But we were still left with flying bombs and rockets.
Yes.
And the rockets were the things that you feared, because you were always afraid that a rocket could suddenly just appear out of the air and explode.
Yeah.
On the ground in front of you.
Yeah, so did you have to have air raid duty, sort of practice and go or did you have to go down to the shelters or wherever you had to go?
No, we did have to get under our typewriters once or twice, because there's two of us at a time on working for the WAF officers.
Yeah.
And at one stage we did get down the floor and sort of sheltered under our typewriters, which were quite sort of solid things.
So you did have... Yeah. What was your accommodation then? Where did you actually stay? Was it close to where you worked?
Well, the first place I stayed in, and I was directed to, was in Portland Street, just off the BBC.
Oh.
And that was a very grand house. And then I was put in some other billets in Victoria.
You were actually working in, was it, would you call it the War Office? What would you call it?
Well, it was Air Ministry Special Signals Office.
I see.
And the special signals came through to the WAF officers who would give us the least secret ones. And we were able to type them and roll them off on a machine and everything. But the very, very secret ones they dealt with.
And I think you told me earlier that, of course, Winston Churchill himself was, well, he was in the room next door or down the corridor?
He was next door, as far as we knew.
Yeah.
But you could never quite be sure. But all I know is that the wall adjoining our two rooms was well sort of... Yes, soundproof.
Yes.
That's the word,
yes.
Soundproof.
Ah.
And so we knew it was something very important.
Yes. Did you ever see him then, round and about?
I did see him, but he was always disappearing down a passageway.
Yes.
And I was probably going the other way.
Yeah,
and he was going that way.
Yeah.
And so we never really crossed paths.
No, but you probably saw other, can I say, bigwigs of
yes,
the time.
Yes, I did. I saw the cabinet office people at the same time, and out of the window on one occasion we saw General Smuts, Bevan, I think it was, and various people like that.
Yeah.
So we did see quite a few people, and they had a special entrance facing St. James Park, I think.
I see.
Their entrance would have been, just like our windows face the park.
Mm.
And did you ever have to type or send messages to anyone important?
Well, yes, I did send a message once to the king.
The king?
The king, yes, and that was, of course, King George at the time.
Yes, yes.
And I think it said, well, I'm not sure whether it did say, have you heard of Accident to Valiant? To Mountbatten, I'm not positive, but I know I typed a message to the king on one occasion for something. The message about the Valiant was, have you heard of Accident to Valiant?
And that rang alarm bells, didn't it?
It did.
Because why is that?
My boyfriend was on the Valiant,
and
I was writing to him every other day or so, and I used to say, well, I hope you're all right. I hope you're quite safe. And he knew I couldn't say any more than that. And I knew I couldn't say very much more either to him. And so it was when he came home and he wanted to know why had I been so concerned. And I said, well, I knew there was an accident to Valiant. And what was it?
Yeah.
Well, a dry dock had collapsed in Trincomalee holding this battleship. And of course, that was a very heavy, big thing to have anything happen to.
So, were people hurt? Was it?
I don't think anybody was hurt, but my boyfriend was on the gangway adjoining from the ship itself, where it was suspended. It had gangways crossing onto the main key part of it, and he sort of
managed to
rush across, and he was okay, but he couldn't quite understand. He knew why it was I was probably concerned, but he didn't know how I knew it, because he didn't really know her.
Your boyfriend, who's a sailor in the Navy, what was his name?
Richard Leonard.
Right. I know you told me you met him. Subsequently, you met him in London, and you had a rendezvous, shall I say, under a clock somewhere. It sounds very romantic.
Yes.
And tell us what happened.
Well, I was so excited, I kind of grabbed his arm.
Yeah.
And snapped. This wristlet. He got a sort of thing holding his watch, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was a tortoiseshell, a bit brittle, you see.
So you were a bit too keen, really, Mary, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
And did this fall off then? And
well, I think it must have fallen.
It
was useless. It was thrown away.
Well, we'll come back to when you married him, not long later, after the war. But I'm interested to know, because this is the big 80th anniversary of VE Day, tell us how you first heard about the war in Europe coming to an end.
I suppose we were leading up to it with our messages that were being sent to and fro between the various heads of state.
But so it was in the air. You knew something was happening.
And I knew. We came off duty at 3 o'clock, and there were people going past, and we thought, well, where's everybody going? What are they doing? And we stuck around for a little while, and then we thought, well, the only thing we can do is to follow up and do the same as they're doing. Yeah. And we found that we were walking down the Mall and making for Buckingham Palace.
So you were swept along with the crowd,
yes,
really?
Yes, and there was thousands of people.
Yeah.
And it always amazes me to think, where did all these people come from? They all must have come out of offices and things. And I mean, most people would have been in uniform, and there were a lot of people in uniform that were joining them. There was two of us in uniform as well. And we were swept along right down to the palace.
And you got there and you saw the balcony, presumably.
Oh,
you could see
yes.
Who was on the balcony?
Yeah, well, the king and queen.
Yeah.
And the Princess Elizabeth.
Yeah, yeah.
And Princess Margaret.
Yeah.
Yes, and there was all the waving and cheering. And I was so afraid I was going to be trampled on because there were so many people. It's like these football crowds that you hear
really,
about.
Yeah.
And you... you know that people can get trampled on, can't they?
Yes, absolutely.
But anyway, we survived it. And,
it must have been very exciting, though, the atmosphere.
Well, it was. Yes, I suppose it was.
Yes. Well, I'm going to have a slight pause here because we're going to listen to Churchill himself, because he later came out on the balcony and
made a victory
speech. So we'll just listen to that now. It might take you back a bit.
God bless you all.
Well, Mary, we're coming to the end of your story. The war has ended, but 3 weeks later, wedding bells began to ring. Tell us about May 1945, the 29th, I think, was the date.
Yes, it was.
Well, presumably we're talking now back to Devon for the wedding.
Yes, well, we had decided that we were thinking of getting married, because it was quite likely that my boyfriend then, he could have been drafted again. Yes. To join a ship and go to Korea.
Oh, yes.
You see, into the Japanese War.
Mm.
And so he thought there'd be... Well, we both were thinking about it. Mm. But when I got home, I found that my mother had already organised a wedding dress for me. And she borrowed one from one of her friends.
Oh, no pressure then.
So we sort of thought, well, we'd better get on with this. And he had to go to Exeter to apply for special permission to married.
Oh, really?
During the war.
Yeah.
I mean, with service people, you had to do it. And so that was rather hurried us up.
Yeah, I suppose it wasn't a huge wedding in the sense that, I mean, no. With rations and so on.
Well, there would have been about 30 of us, I suppose.
That you managed to feed everybody. And
Yes, and we were all crammed into my parents'. We had quite a big dining room, actually. Mm. And it was well, almost as big as this room, I suppose.
This is Buckfast Lee.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
The folks were very good. They gave us things that they'd received from Australia mainly. People used to send tins of meat and things like that.
Right.
to various relatives. Yes, and it all went off.
But were you able to have a toast, as in any alcohol?
Oh, yes, because my new father-in-law, he was something to do with one of the vineyard wine people. He always had sort of a bottle of something he could produce.
Well, that's very handy, isn't it?
Yes, but the alarming part was I went up to change in my bedroom with my mother, and the next thing I know is she's looking out the window and shrieking, no, don't, oh, you can't use that, oh, no, you mustn't use that. And one of our friends had got a tin of treacle, and he had poured it all over my husband's car.
Oh, no.
Yes, and it was all running down the sides.
His idea of a joke.
And then they'd thrown confetti on
top. Oh, no. Oh,
and
dear.
So we went off with things being boots and shoes.
This is off to the honeymoon.
Where did you?
Where did you go?
We went down to Bude.
Oh yes.
The first thing we did, we had to put the car in a garage there, and my husband sort of then said, "Well, we'll come back in the morning and clean it up."
Yeah.
In the morning when we went back, it was all perfectly clean.
Really?
The staff there were so sorry for us.
Oh, that was a nice touch.
Yes, and so they cleaned it all up for us.
Oh, marvellous. And you were married for a good number of years.
Yes, well, from 1945 to 6 went down.
We have one of your daughters with us now, Di, who's listening to us, so she's putting us right if we get any dates wrong. So you had a lovely long...
It was coming up for 70 years.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You had the diamond wedding.
Yeah, you had your diamond wedding, yes. And probably a card from the Queen for that.
Oh, yes, I've got a special picture of the Queen hung up.
Yeah, oh, great.
I framed it.
Oh, really? Yeah. I know, obviously, you couldn't travel much when you got married, but subsequently, later in life, you have travelled quite a bit. You and your husband went around the world in all sorts of places, didn't
you? Well, we went to most places. Yeah. But I know the first... When we decided we could go somewhere, he sort of said to me, where would I most like to go? And I said, oh, I'd love to go to Venice. I think Venice must be a wonderful place to go to.
Yeah.
And so we went to Venice, and it was lovely.
Yes.
It was
very romantic, I would imagine.
Yeah,
so that's one of your... But look, we could talk all day, Mary, and I'm aware that time is going. What we haven't spoken about, before I ask you to choose a piece of music, is your experience. You actually danced to the real Glenn Miller. He was in London when, I think, Soho, when you were stationed there. And you did actually... Well, tell us about it.
Yes, I used to belong to a club there, and it was a club for service people. We used to go there and dance, and we had various big bands that used to play, and we were all able to dance on the platform. But when Glenn Miller came, that was a completely different band. It was such a large band, there must have been nearly 20 people in it, really, because there were there was a couple of singers, there was two or three saxophone players, and it was most amazing, it really was.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, not many people can say they have danced to Glenn Miller and his band.
We couldn't dance because the whole of the stage...
Oh, I see, it was all taken up for that. There's just too many of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, look, Mary, I could talk all day, but we're going to finish with a piece of music. I mean, you might choose Glenn Miller or you might choose something else, but I wonder, what would you like to finish with?
Oh, I'd love to hear Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade.
Serenade, that's the one, yeah. Yes,
Moonlight
Serenade. Well, I'm sure we can dig that record out of our archive and play for you. We'll listen to that, but before we do, I'll just say, before I hand over to Glenn Miller anyway, with much appreciation to Mary Overall for recording your memories. Thank you. And I just happen to know that I think sometime soon the BBC are coming to, with a crew and whoever, who knows. And so we might see you on, I don't know, Spotlight or something.
It should be V-Day celebrations.
So
we look forward to... I'll have to ask for your autograph later. But it's lovely to have spoken to you. And from both of us now, we'll say goodbye.
Well, goodbye, and thank you for speaking to me like this. Very kind of you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.